This is Ozarks at Large. In 1917, Albert Einstein presented the theoretical foundations for the laser. It would be decades later until a laser was demonstrated. Now a reality for more than 50 years, the laser has become an integral part of the technological landscape. Earlier this month, Dr. Robert Beyer, the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of the School of Humanities and Sciences in the Department of Applied Physics at Stanford University, discussed the laser's history, contemporary uses, and possible future applications on the University of Arkansas campus. He was the 2014 Robert D. Maurer Distinguished Lecturer, a guest of the U of A's Department of Physics. While here, he talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the laser.
So I call the laser the stealth utility. It's used in more ways than you can imagine, and it's surprisingly that it has solved problems that we didn't even know exist when the laser was invented. So the focus of my talk tonight is not on the laser itself, but on discovering these problems that were solved by the laser in some unique way. And I'll call, you know, so I'm going to tease the audience a little bit. Think about it. Do you know something the laser does in your life that's so surprising you would have never thought about it in advance?
Well, I know that most of what a laser does in our everyday life, we never see, right?
Well, for example, you carry a cell phone. That cell phone is manufactured with a laser. The glass corners are cut with a laser. The microelectronics in that cell phone are all made with a laser. And without the laser, you would not be able to carry a cell phone in your pocket.
GPS, doesn't that count?
GPS counts as a technology. It's not directly laser-related, but the clocks that are used in GPS are atomic clocks. And just a few weeks ago, the most precise clock ever made by man was made by Junier and his group at the University of Colorado. It loses only 1 second in 10 to the 18 seconds. What is 10 to the 18 seconds? That's the life of the universe, 13.7 billion years. So this clock is so good that in the entire time the universe has existed, it's only lost 1 second.
And we'll allow that. From the days of the infancy of the laser, has it always been considered something that would change our lives?
No. In fact, quite early on, Art Shallow coined the phrase, the laser is a solution looking for a problem. So for the first 10 years, we had no idea what to do with this new form of light. We knew it was direct. We knew we could focus it. It was gaining power and extending its color range. But we had no clue about how best to use the laser and what it could do for us.
Well, you mentioned the color range. I read a presentation you put together about your life with the laser, and there would be these little things like people would get excited about orange or blue or a new color. What would those new colors signify?
Well, early on, the lasers were single wavelength or single color. And in fact, every new laser that was invented for the first 10 years was reported in the literature. A certain laser was invented. It has a wavelength of this amount. And then the next week, you'd read in the article, oh, another new laser has been invented. What we needed was the ability to tune the wavelength continuously across the range of colors. And by luck, the project I worked on for my thesis was a tunable laser source. And we were lucky to get it to work. It barely worked, but it did. And it was tunable. So I built the first tunable visible laser in our laboratory in 1968-69. It was a big deal then. And now today, it's not such a big deal. We do it all the time. But like radio frequencies, we have as much control over laser light today as we have over radio frequencies that make radio broadcasting possible.
When you were working on that thesis in 1968, 1969, did you have a grand idea of what laser might be able to do?
No grand idea, but I had ideas of what we could do. And we used the tunability to begin a program on remote atmospheric sensing, transmit the laser beam into the atmosphere, tune the color to the molecular resonance. And over the years, we were able to detect carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We could detect methane. We could detect water vapor. We could measure temperature. And our goal in the long term was to show that this remote sensing tool called the laser could be useful for first ground-based remote sensing and then space-based remote sensing. So 2 days ago, I got a call from NASA, from Upendra Singh. And Upendra said, you know, Beyer, he says, I want to invite you to our next conference on laser remote sensing that's be held in Asia this summer. And we're doing the following things. And indeed, all the things that we were trying to do and we were learning how to do in the 1980s are now flying in space. The lasers are in space. They're doing the measurements from space on a global scale. And it's timely. We need to be able to do these measurements.
Is this something that's sort of exponential, that the more you know about it, the more you can do, and it speeds up development and understanding?
It is exponential, both in the capability of the laser, the number of lasers being applied, and the range of applications. And so the surprise is the range of solutions that have been found for the laser that weren't even questions when it was invented.
And there are practical, I mean, for the layperson, there are these practical, not just cell phones, but using it to, what, strip paint and things like that?
Strip paint is one. I call that subtractive manufacturing, but that was a surprise to me. We had known that the lasers that we were building were so powerful they would strip the black paint off our power meter. That was obvious. I mean, the power meter had to be repainted after you use the laser. But it never dawned on me there would actually be a use for the laser in stripping paint. And there is. And it turns out stripping paint from an aircraft is a big business. It's about $500 million a year business just to repaint airplanes every year. And you're not allowed to use chemicals to strip the paint. So it's now expensive to strip the paint. But a laser does it without chemicals. It remains dry. You can continue working on the aircraft as you strip the paint and repaint it. When we explained this to the vice president of Boeing a number of years ago, his first question was, well, if you can take the paint off, can you put it back on?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it is. And the answer is yes. You change the laser pulse length from being a short pulse, a billionth of a second, to being a longer pulse, a millionth of a second. And then you make the paint in a plastic form, you just remelt it back on the aircraft. So you can repaint the airplane as well.
Okay, so when you're working or researching on laser properties and technologies, what does the workspace look like? I mean, I have this image of a science fiction white lab coat, big goggles.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Only in Hollywood do scientists all wear white lab coats okay. And be in the basement and look like geeks. And the good news is we have a program on TV that sort of celebrates geekiness now. So the Big Bang Theory has, I think, changed people's attitude. Maybe I can be a geek and do what I want to do and it's okay. But our labs really are not that complicated, and it's optical benches and a lot of optical components. And we used to build big lasers and require a lot of power. Now the lasers have gotten much smaller, so now we can have two or three experiments on a simple optical table. The remarkable thing is everywhere you go in the world, whether it's from China or Germany or the U.S., when you're inside a laser lab, they all look the same.
Really?
They really do.
I imagine they're clean?
They're clean. We try to keep them clean because dust particles on the laser give us difficulties. I've had more difficulty in the past when my students would bring lunch into the lab and leave a little crumbs around. Then the ants would come, and I've had an ant kill a laser before, so.
Really?
It crawled right on the end of the laser rod. And when we fired the laser, the ant got burnt, but it also damaged the optics.
Well, okay, this brings up, you mentioned Hollywood. And Hollywood's first depictions of lasers, anyone who's seen a 50s or 60s science fiction movie or an early James Bond film knows that lasers in films were used as weapons and
yes.
Cutting things. And are lasers used in defense?
They are now, and it took 50 years. But early on, one of the movies about lasers cutting things was called Real Genius. It was filmed at Caltech in the 1970s. And they actually went into the laser labs and took photographs of the then existing lasers. And it's a remarkable sort of thing to look back in time in a movie. The closing scene of the movie is famous, and it was actually picked up by Mythbusters. The closing scene is the big megawatt laser illuminates a can of Jiffy Pop popcorn. Popcorn was in an aluminum metal dish, and you put it over the fire and shook it, right? So the laser caused the popcorn to pop, and everybody was then showered with popcorn. So a few years ago, Mythbusters showed up in our lab and said, you know, we want to test this. This has to be untrue. There's no way that a laser can pop popcorn. And we said, no, we're pretty sure lasers can pop popcorn today. And then they made it really difficult. Well, in the movie, the popcorn was in an aluminum can. We have to wrap the kernel into aluminum. I said, yeah, you're really making our life more difficult. But we popped the kernel of corn. And that episode is on Mythbusters if you want to go check it out.
You can pop popcorn with a laser.
You can.
I imagine then it is difficult to know what the laser will be doing 40 years from now.
Not so difficult. I'll talk about that in surprising applications of lasers. So what I usually tell my students is lasers are now powerful enough to cut metal at a distance. That's meant to be a euphemism for if there's an aircraft at 20 kilometers, the laser can now cut it out of the sky. And you can see this in real time. Just go on YouTube. All the youngsters in the audience can do this. And type defense high power laser. That's all you have to type, defense high power laser. And you get a little movie clip of a laser shooting down a little helicopter, shooting down a drone aircraft, shooting down an artillery shell, for gosh sakes, and then shooting down a rocket coming at the, in into the scene. So lasers are now of enough power to be able to cut metal at a distance.
This is, you're not telling me this to make me sleep better, I take it.
No, in fact, there's real applications for this because lasers are a defensive weapon and they're very precise in what they do. They don't create havoc everywhere. They only destroy what you point them at. But the surprise to me, the surprising application was that lasers are now being used to cut metal at a distance commercially. There's a market, and the market is to disassemble nuclear power plants. And the first example is Fukushima. So after the tremendous earthquake and tidal wave in 2011 that destroyed that nuclear power plant, you need to be able to remove the material. It's radioactive. You can send welders in and gown them up and hope that they can cut through the steel and the concrete, but it exposes people unnecessarily to the residual radiation. The solution is the laser. It turns out a 100-kilowatt commercial laser now being manufactured can cut the Fukushima power plant into small cubes that could be picked up by helicopter and flown to a disposal site without humans being anywhere close. You're a kilometer standoff distance. That's a surprising application of a high-power laser. And it's not going to be the first time it will be used this way. There are many nuclear power plants ending their life now, their lifespan, and they're going to have to be dismantled. And if you have a way to dismantle them that allows you to be at a standoff distance yet be effective, it will be a real useful tool.
I imagine there are still other applications that we can't even imagine yet.
There are. So my favorite one is there's been research for now 50 years. It's called laser fusion. And everybody says, you know, fusion is that idea that's always 50 years in the future. But in January, the National Ignition Facility laser, the world's largest laser, made a major step forward in trying to create a miniature star in our laboratory. And they walked up, we call the threshold curve, a good step, and the paper was published and got some press. So we're one big step toward reaching the point where the laser can squeeze hydrogen gas tight enough that it will begin to generate energy from atomic fusion. And that's the same source of energy that our sun and virtually every star you see in the sky uses. So nature got there first. Nature uses gravity to bring the star together till it's hot enough that it begins to fuse hydrogen and deuterium to make helium. We're using the laser as artificial gravity to compress the small millimeter pellet to create a small source of fusion material. Now, if we do this 15 times a second, we have a power plant. The power plant is laser-driven. And my dream 50 years from now, laser-driven fusion engines will literally be the power source for the world. We'll just call it laser energy. Everybody will acknowledge that it's just like the, you know, the center of the sun. We're burning hydrogen to generate helium. It's a clean source of energy. And that is an application for the laser, is to do that and make it a reality.
Wow. One last question. Do you remember as a young man or a boy what first sparked an interest in science?
I remember well because I grew up in a place called Pasadena, California, which was the home of the big telescopes in California at that time. And my grandfather was the machinist at the Pasadena machine shop that provided the support and the tooling for the Mount Wilson Observatory and then later for the Palomar Observatory. So the first thing that I saw as a young boy was the Mount Wilson Observatory and the ability to walk in on the floor and stand beneath this large telescope. And since that time, I've been an amateur astronomer. I tell my friends in my amateur astronomy club, I get paid to do physics. I don't get paid to do astronomy. So I do astronomy because I have a passion for it. It's just a delightful thing to do. And so two nights ago, I was up most of the night watching the total eclipse.
Yeah. Did you have a clear sky for it?
Not very clear in the Bay Area. It looked like it might have been much more clear here.
It was beautiful here, yeah.
Yeah, but I did get images from the beginning to the end, a shot taken every 2.5 minutes. I haven't had time to develop the movie yet, but it'll be a nice movie.
Anything else we should know?
I have a passion for science as well. And I think those of us who work in our lives in science really look at science as a tool that we can use to improve the global situation, improve our health, really make the world a better place for people to live. And we're on the very early times in our scientific age as a society, just a blink of an eye in the time of human existence. But there's been enormous changes in the world in that very short time, and I hope it continues in the future.
Robert L. Beyer is William R. Kinnon, Jr. Professor of the School of Humanities and Sciences in the Department of Applied Physics at Stanford, where he has been conducting research and teaching classes in lasers and nonlinear optics since 1969. He was the 2014 Maurer Distinguished Lecturer at the University of Arkansas this month. The Maurer Lecture Series is sponsored by the Department of Physics and the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellams while in Northwest Arkansas.